How did you first start to play?
You mean when I was a little boy?
Yeah.
My brother. My brother started me playing trumpet because my father had bought him a Sears Roebuck trumpet. My father was a cornet player, and he bought him a trumpet. And Cannonball played the trumpet really well, but he just didn't have much range and endurance. So he switched to alto saxophone. Then he started teaching me to play trumpet so that Pop wouldn't be disappointed that neither one of the boys played trumpet.
What made you think that the trumpet was the right instrument for you?
I had no idea whether the trumpet was the right instrument. I started playing it because I had to play something, you know, because I was a singer in this little group we had when we were kids. And I knew that I was going to have to play an instrument sooner or later. So when Cannon said, "Why don't you play trumpet?" I said, "Great, give it here." So I learned to play trumpet.
Did you get any musical direction from your father? Did he have any expectations about what type of music you'd be playing?
Pop really was a good musician. He wanted to be sure we learned to read music because the tendency at that time was to just jam around and not really learn to play the instrument well. But we were fortunate. We grew up in Tallahassee, Florida, a university town. So we had good training in addition to starting to work, you know, playing dances very early. I think I was 9 years old, or younger, 8 years old, when we started working in nightclubs with our little group. And the band director at Florida A&M, where we eventually went to a college, was the college roommate, my father's college roommate, and he was a wonderful musician. So he taught all of us, you know, from early childhood, he taught us, and he taught us very well, I think.
Did you played a lot with your brother when you were young?
We always played together. But he's 3 years older, so he finished college and left me there. And for those 3 years, we didn't play together. But other than that, we always did.
3 years when you're young seems like an enormous gap, right?
Right. You know, when one's 16 and one's 13, then the 16-year-old and one, you know, one little brother tagging along. But you had to tag along on the gigs because it was my band. And he... I couldn't go to work unless he went to work because he's the older brother supposed to look out for me. So he worked in my band, and then eventually we got to New York, and then I worked in his band.
I know that some musicians, when they started playing professionally and playing with their own band and with other people's bands, felt that maybe they came out too soon. And well, like Parker's the best example of that, that there's a lot of stories about how he would take all these solos and end up getting just losing his place or losing himself and feeling like he'd really better go back and woodshed for a while before he came out again. Did that ever happen to you, or did things go pretty smoothly?
I never heard that story. Generally, young musicians, just as we were, you know, when you're young and you don't know that much about music, you know, if you can emulate solos from other people, then you think you're as good as they are. So I thought I was very good.
Who were you emulating when you were young?
Oh, the same trumpet players that I love now. I always liked Dizzy Gillespie and Miles Davis, and they were the trumpet players to emulate at that time. Then Clark Terry, the late Kenny Durham, and in recent years I like Freddie Hubbard and Woody Shaw. And at one point I was very much involved with Chet Baker, too.
Some of the musicians had pretty drastic changes in the kind of music that they play. Have you ever been disappointed by the musical direction someone has taken?
Many times. You mean my friends?
Friends or people who you know mostly through their music and their records?
Well, yes, I've been very disappointed at I've been disappointed at many of the musical directions that, quote-unquote, jazz has taken. But I sort of balance it off against the fact that I understand how difficult it is to earn a living in this business. So if a guy makes money doing something that I know is a lesser music, I sort of go along with him as long as he plays some music sometime. The general hybrid fusion forms with rock beats in the last few years, I've been disappointed that some of my friends have gone in that direction. I know they know that the music is not really that good, but some of them are very successful. And I do admire the fact that, when we came up from Florida, my brother and I, there were always, when musicians died, there were benefits for them. You know, there were benefits for Charlie Parker's family and benefits for Billie Holiday's family and benefits for Lester Young. But in recent years, I've noticed that there have been fewer benefits for jazz musicians, which means that maybe in the coming years, we won't have to be playing so many benefits because some of these people who have transgressed the music have nonetheless earned a living and at least they've come out with something.
What have you felt has been the most commercially successful music that you've recorded? Is that has that matched up with the music that you most like to play?
I never played any music I didn't want to play. And the most commercially successful music that we've had, and we had a lot of records, and of course I've written a lot of music that has been successful, but it's been by accident. If I knew how to formularize it some kind of way, if I really knew what I was doing, and then I'd duplicate those successful ones and make a lot of money too, because I never felt that they were lacking in musicality, at least certainly compared to what I hear today. Now, but everything that we ever did, you know, just happened, and it just happened at a particular time that something caught someone's ear. So the commerciality of it was only brought into focus because the public bought it, not because it was geared some way for some commercial appeal.
But you never knew when you were in the studio that this was going to be a big hit and get played on the radio, really catch up.
I have thought that four or five songs, as we recorded them, were going to be hit records, and I was wrong.
Which ones were those that you thought?
Oh, I don't remember because they just ended up on albums.
Right.
I felt that Mercy Mercy was going to be a big record. That was the only one that I was right. That I felt. The other ones that I thought were going to be big records were not.
Well, I remember when Mercy Mercy was on the radio, and it was, well, there was very little jazz on the stations mm-hmm. that were played in my house at that time, and it had mm-hmm. made it into, I think, a lot of different formats.
Right.
And, for me, in some ways, it really helped introduce me to jazz. I remember liking it a lot and wondering why there weren't things like it that they played on those stations as well. But it takes you a while till you're old enough or just smart enough to go hear the things that you want to hear and find more of what you want to hear.
You know, one of the things that I wanted to mention, especially being in Philadelphia, we used to love Philadelphia. I still love Philadelphia. But we particularly like Philadelphia because Philadelphia always had, it seems to me, the most erudite jazz fans of any of the cities.
In what way?
The people who came to the club knew what was good. They knew when it was really good and knew when it was not so good. So you had to be on top of your playing when you came to Philadelphia. For one thing, Philadelphia had so many fine musicians, local musicians, who could walk on a bandstand and play with anybody. I wouldn't dare venture to mention names because I'd leave too many people out. But in fact, on the same album with Mercy Mercy, there's a song called Hippadelphia. We titled that song Hippadelphia because that's the way we felt about Philadelphia, that it was the hippest city.
You still feel that way?
I haven't been to Philadelphia in a long time now,
yeah.
And I don't really know whether there's still that same erudite quality in the listening public. But for a number of years, that's the way it was. We felt that Philadelphia was the most erudite listening town.
Do other cities have identities to you?
Next to Philadelphia, there was Detroit. Detroit had so many musicians. You could also see a thread where there were a lot of fine musicians. There were usually a lot of really erudite jazz listeners. Chicago has always been one of my favorite places to play for the same reason. But Philadelphia by far, even more than New York. Philadelphia.
Well, I was recently in New York and went to a number of clubs there. One of the things that really struck me was how at all of the clubs there seemed to be a really wide range of people who'd show up. Different ages, black and white listeners, people with fur coats, people wearing jeans. You know, you could tell that people with varying amounts of money were showing up for the concerts.
True.
Probably a lot more so, I think, than in Philadelphia.
Well, by now, New York is in the middle of what I think is a major renaissance. There are more clubs in New York now than ever. There are so many jazz clubs that some of them are not even listed in the brochures of those magazines, Q Magazine and those the New Yorker list all the attractions. I feel that when there's a renaissance in New York, there's going to be a renaissance everywhere else. Well, when you travel like I do, in the last couple of years, the biggest renaissance area has been the South. There are clubs in funny places in the South now, jazz clubs. You know that I live in Florida. There are two or three clubs in Florida. Florida never had jazz clubs.
What do you think accounts for that?
I think it's just that people are tired of the same old soup warmed over, and a lot of people are listening more to things that are a little beyond. Jazz is by nature, for want of a better term, avant-garde. It must be in front. One of the reasons that I never think that jazz is going to be really big pop music is because it has to remain in front. Otherwise, the pop people 10 years from now won't know what to do, because usually the pop comes along 10, 20 years later. I hear Duke Ellington 1940 cliches in the pop music today, but of course masses of audiences could not hear it then.
Right. Well, how do you think the music business has changed since you've been playing? Like record companies, for instance. I think a record contract has a different meaning now than it did, say, 20 years ago.
You betcha.
What are some of those differences?
Well, there were all the little jazz labels, but these small companies have all been swallowed up. There's not a great emphasis on the music from the major labels, but that is not, it's not endemic to jazz or the entertainment industry. It's just a national trend. Large conglomerates are buying up small companies. And as the large conglomerates buy up small companies, they tend to lean toward that which has the most appeal, they think, to the general public. So if you got a product, you want to sell the product. That's all that music is to business people, is a product. When the labels come on the music, you know, we have a penchant in this country for categorizing and numbering and labeling things so that each thing in its own little place, in its own little niche. Well, jazz is not one of the things that is to be sold. There are other catchphrases, rock and roll or pop. These are labels that are to be sold to masses of people. Jazz is not one. So we don't expect to have someone turn around and give a massive push to the music, but we still feel that we have to be committed to playing the music.
You used to be on contract to Riverside, right?
Oh, I've been under contract to quite a few companies. I'm not under contract to a company now.
Mm-hmm. But okay, what did it mean? Say you were on contract to Riverside.
Mm-hmm.
What did it mean? What were you supposed to be doing for them, and what was their commitment to you?
Well, you're supposed to do, according to contract, either 2 or 3 albums a year, you know, on a royalty basis and with an advance against royalties, and they're supposed to sell it and pay you. They're supposed to publicize it and pay you, and you're supposed to continue recording. And there were no stipulations as to what kind of music one was to play. We played what we wanted. Most of the time when I recorded, I wrote some of the music, and some of the music I got from other guys.
Is it worth it now to be under contract to a company, or is it better to just record for... Because your last, I think, 3 albums are for 3 different record companies.
Right.
Is it better for you to be independent now?
At this point, most of the companies who have, quote-unquote, jazz artists under contract have producers who produce those fusion kinds of records. I'm not going to do that. You know, there are a few small companies and some Japanese companies who you can go in and still do your music. Those are the companies that I deal with, the few independents left. But I'm not going to sign a contract with someone and then have them tell me what to play. I've never had anybody tell me what to play. So I believe that the record companies are wrong. I believe that if you play what you play and play it well, that there's a profit margin in it. Otherwise, all those companies would not have been in business all those years.
Right. What for you makes a good producer?
I think that a good producer for jazz is one who manages to stay out of the way and let the musician play what he wants to play. Because it's a creative process. And if you interfere with the creativity, then you have, in effect, destroyed music.
There's been records I've heard where I felt that the producer or somebody should have demanded that there be another take because it sounds close, but like it's not quite working, or someone's solo is really a mess.
Well, it's according to what you're listening for.
What? Uh-huh.
You know, when I listen to music, you know, I listen to all kinds of music. But to limit it to jazz, when I listen to, say, trumpet players,
mm-hmm.
Well, when I listen to Miles Davis, I listen to Miles Davis for his superlatives. Miles Davis is maybe the greatest thinker in the history of the trumpet, because he's not really a trumpet technician in the true classical sense of trumpet players. He's not a great trumpet player at all. But what he thinks of to play, nobody else thinks of that to play, at least up to a point. There have been some records that I don't know what Miles is thinking, but generally. On the other hand, I can very well listen to Maynard Ferguson just to hear him play the trumpet, because he doesn't think creatively like Miles does. And what he does is easily emulatable if you can play the trumpet that well. I listen to him for his instrumental ability. And that's it. I'm not going to listen to him for the same reason I listen to Miles, because under those circumstances, everybody loses. When I listen to Dizzy Gillespie, I listen to somebody play with total command of creativity, instrumental technique, the entire shamil. Freddie Hubbard is perhaps the most fluent instrumentalist playing the trumpet in terms of pure trumpet playing in the classical tradition. But so I'm not going to listen to Freddie for what Miles would play. And to take another instrument, suppose we really listen to Thelonious Monk for piano technique, then Monk wouldn't be great. Or if we listen to Oscar Peterson play for the Monk content, we wouldn't listen to Oscar Peterson. So I just listen to people for what I believe their superlatives are and base my reaction on that. If they do what their superlatives are well, then I'm satisfied.
But sometimes you hear a recording and you feel like you know what this musician is capable of and that they somehow just fell short of that in a certain take within the session. Like, how do you know when a take is what you wanted?
When you play, you have to use the same general philosophy. I use the same general philosophy that I do when I listen to other people. No one knows what I intend to do but me and God. God's not going to tell, and I'm not either. If I played what I intended to play, then that's it. When I listen to other people, I don't know what they intended to play. That's why jazz is such a fascinating music. A lot of times, great innovations come about as a result of what I believe were initially errors, a missed note. But a note is not wrong if you have enough musicality to justify it in your following measures. In other words, you can play a wrong note and by going through a quick musical cycle justify that note being there. If you can do it and do it well, then you have an innovation.
Yeah.
So when I record, I base most of whether I let a record go or not on the feeling of the record, the general feeling. There can be an awful lot of notes missed, but if the feeling was right, if the portrayal of the song was right to me, then that's it.
Uh-huh.
That's more important than a note here or there, or a chord out of place, because we should be able to justify those.
I know Miles Davis's playing has been a great inspiration to you. Have you been close with him personally?
No, not at all.
He's a, I understand, difficult person to get close to.
Well, I don't know. I never made any honest effort. I know Miles, and I respect his music greatly. I have no great feelings about him one way or the other. In fact, I guess I don't really hate people, and I don't, you know, I dislike some people. I guess that were it not for Miles' music, I probably wouldn't like him at all. But I admire his music so much that I'm willing to let the music override the fact that basically, with a personality, I think he's got a personality that basically clashes with what my personality is, from my standpoint.
But you can't let something like that stand in the way of your
appreciation. No, it has nothing at all to do with the music. You know, I'm a great sports fan, and there's some great sports figures that I don't like, but I'm certainly not going to say that they're not good at what they do.
Right.
They're very good at what they do.
Well, you're, I guess, intentionally outside of the living areas that are considered to be the mainstreams of jazz, like New York, Los Angeles for studio musicians. Mm-hmm. Chicago is more of a jazz center than Florida is. Mm-hmm. What keeps you living in Florida? And is it hard to be living in a state that doesn't have the kind of jazz focus that some other states and cities do?
No, it's not hard at all. As a matter of fact, the last 10 years, the last 10 years of the Cannonball Adderley Quintet before Cannon died, Cannonball and our drummer, Roy McCurdy, lived in Los Angeles. Walter Booker, the bassist, and me, and we had two or three piano players during that period, always lived in New York. We made the same gigs. We rehearsed on the road when we were traveling. So it occurred to me that it really doesn't matter where I live. I'm going to have to go somewhere else
right.
to play anyway. So I might as well live where I want to. So I wanted to live in Florida.
I love
Florida.
That's where you grew up, right?
Yeah.
What do you love about it?
The weather, the people. See, you can live in Florida and be a person without being an entertainer. You know, I can go around. I live in Lakeland, Florida. It's not a very large town. And I can walk around, and nobody, for a long time, people didn't even know who I was. And I could just be a citizen like other people. The previous 20 years, I lived in Teaneck, New Jersey. A lot of jazz musicians live in Teaneck, nice suburban town. But there was always that entertainer facade you had to live up to. People expect, when you're a jazz musician, they expect you to be a little weird. So sometimes I'd have to do little weird things just so that people would you know, they expect it from you. In Florida, I don't have to do anything. I can just go around and be whatever I want to be.
Is that because everybody knows you or because everybody's oblivious to jazz?
I think it's both. I think it's a little of both. I think they really don't know that much about jazz. By now, they basically know who I am, but they don't really know what I do because I will never play there.
I know a lot of people like to leave the place that they grew up in, so that, because in a way you're really special in your hometown, because people are particularly proud of the fact that they helped spawn you in some way.
But on the other hand,
they take you for granted, right?
There's a misunderstanding. I don't live in my hometown.
Oh, I see. So
I live 250 miles from my hometown. I wouldn't go back there.
How come?
For the same reasons. I'd still be on stage.
Uh-huh. Because you're...
My mother and father are still there. And, you know, whenever there's a concert or whatever, you know, the musicians all know them and they go to the house. And, you know, I'd be on stage all the time.
Yeah.
I want to be able to create at home and then go do what I do on stage rather than to be on stage when I'm at home. When I'm at home, I should be at home. And I just like Florida. I always wanted to live on a lake. There weren't any lakes in New York City.
Oh, come on. There's lots of lakes in Manhattan.
Oh, yeah, just that one. one out in Central Park. They don't let you build a house there.
Oh, that's for sure. When you were playing with Cannonball, was there ever a sense of competition between the two of you being brothers?
I don't believe... The reason I slowed down is because what you asked me is to make a judgment for him also.
Oh, yeah, right.
You see?
Yeah.
From my standpoint... No. In fact, I was always very proud of Cannon when he did things and when he won awards and what have you, and the band won awards. I felt very proud. The name's the same.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, we were partners. We were always partners. We were partners when we were kids and he was working for me. I paid him half of the money. Whatever I earned, he got half. So... when we became professional musicians and got a band, then it became much bigger business, so we had to have a corporation, and there we are. We were always partners.
What's your parents' reaction been to your music?
Well, I remember when we were leaving, we were getting ready to leave. See, I left first, though I was younger.
You left Florida first?
Yeah, I got a job with Lionel Hampton when I got right out of school. I went back. And I told him, that's the year that Charlie Parker died. And I made my first trip to New York with Lionel Hampton's band. And I went all over town listening to everybody. So when I got a break, I went home and I told Cannon that I hadn't heard any alto players play that I thought were better than he was. And it just happened that he was coming to New York that summer to work on his master's at NYU. So when he came and we got a job, the first night, went and sat in with Oscar Pettiford for the band and got a job. He never did enroll in NYU. And we did have to go back to Florida because he had signed a contract for the first semester to teach. In that semester, my mother said, I knew you were going to convince your brother to leave that good job and go out playing that music, playing that Chinese music, is what she called it. And I told my mama, Cannonball's 3 years older than I am, and he outweighs me by 50 pounds. I can convince him to do anything he didn't want to do. But if you choose to believe that, then fine. We left, but when the first records came out, mama was the first one with the records. They say, see my boys? Things change very rapidly according to what they consider success. It's a matter of being successful or unsuccessful. It really doesn't matter that much what you do, provided it's supposed to be legal.
Right. Of all your records, do you have any favorites?
Of my own records?
Yeah.
Yes, I made an album for A&M Records about 12 years ago called Calling Out Loud. It's a it's a record with basically it's just trumpet and rhythm section. That Joe Zawinul, Ron Carter, and I forgot who the drummer was. But then Bill Fisher, arranger, came and wrote for alto flutes behind the thing. I really love that record. That is a favorite of mine. But generally, I like the last record that I made always. I always feel like you make progress as you go along, and I hear things that I didn't hear before. However, I only listen to my records once. When they come out, I listen to them to see what I did. Mm-hmm. Then I don't listen to them anymore because I play those songs, and I have a tendency, if I like something, to repeat it. And the purpose of jazz is to be non-repetitive. So I don't listen to what I play. Once I listen to the record to see how it sounds and what goes down, then I put it in the shelf and I don't play it.
Do you have copies of your records?
Not all of them. My father does.
Uh-huh.
My father has a complete collection.
Do you spend time listening to other people's records?
That's what I spend my time doing. I listen. If I'm going to listen to music, I listen to other people.
So I know a lot of musicians, when they're not playing, feel like they desperately need to get away from music and they won't listen much to records.
I don't see how anybody can ever get away from music. Music's everywhere. So, no, I don't consciously sit down and say, okay, I'm going to listen to records 5 hours a day. I don't mean that. But I listen to records and I listen to music based on what happens at a particular time. Sometimes I don't want to be a musical bigot, you know. I don't want to be a bigot anyway. But a musical bigot decides that because there's a label to something, that he does not like the music because he doesn't like the label. Well, I found myself leaning in that direction when disco hit. I heard the first little stuff and said, oh, this is terrible. And I didn't listen. Then one day I was, you know, just riding along and playing the radio, and there was no jazz station on at the moment. And I heard Donna Summer singing MacArthur Park. And I went out and bought the record and did a whole lot of soul searching and said, maybe I better listen some more because all of no music is bad and all of no music is good.
She's really good, isn't she?
I think she's a good singer.
She was a surprise to me, too.
I heard a country and western singer one day, Jesse Coulter, ran right out and bought the record. I buy a lot of records because I hear something, one track on a radio somewhere, and say, this somebody has got something. As a result, and I have all kinds of music, you know, whatever, it's not just jazz.
So are you a restless radio listener when you're driving in the car going from station to station?
As a matter of fact, I don't listen to radio that much. It's on rare occasions because usually when I'm driving, I'm thinking of music myself. And I'm humming little things to myself, and I'll stop and scratch something on a piece of paper. So it's a rare time for me to be listening to the radio anyway. I listen to the radio very, very seldom.
So is that part of how you compose? You're doing something like driving and
right.
A line comes into your head and you
right.
Try to copy that down.
In fact, that's
down.
One of my good times when I'm driving. And there's some others that I won't mention, but when I'm driving,
right.
I think a lot about music.
Yeah, you know, I think when you're driving, like your arms and your eyes and your feet are all mm-hmm. taken care of. They've got to be driving, but your mind's really free to wander like you want
right.
to.
Especially in places that's like Florida. See, you can't do that in Philadelphia or New York. There's too much traffic.
Oh,
so you
got to
be concentrating on traffic all
yeah,
the time.
Yeah.
But riding up the turnpike, I can think.
When you're putting together a band, whether it's a band like you put together partially for the gig that you just had in Wilmington,
mm-hmm.
where it's not your permanent band,
mm-hmm.
or when you're putting together a band that you're going to be touring with and recording with, what are some of the things you're going to be thinking about in terms of who you want to work with, who's going to sound right with you, who you want to work off of?
You just laid it out.
Mm.
It's the sound. You can have, I'd like to make an analogy. I like basketball. You could have, for a long time, the Boston Celtics were the great basketball team, the professional basketball team. And the perennial runner-up was the Philadelphia Warriors. Had Wilt Chamberlain and a whole bunch of stars on the team. Boston, on the other hand, had Bill Russell and a group of people who were really not that well known, you know, not stars, but they played together. The stars at Philadelphia would do outstanding things individually, but they didn't play together. I believe that a band is the same thing. It doesn't matter who you got if they play together. I listen for people who play together. When I hear people play together well, and it also seems to suit my needs, then I want those people.
Well, how do you go over things? There's obviously not time for a rehearsal beforehand. So how much communication can you have beforehand?
There are marvelous things that you can do in a short while with people in order to get a group feeling. The best thing to do, I can't give away all my little secrets.
Right.
But in order to get everybody involved in the music, you have to play music that is comfortable and let everybody feel comfortable for a minute. Then throw something difficult. Because once you've already established a comfortable feeling, now musicians don't have to think about what they're going to do with each other, but more what they're going to do with the music. Then you try something strange. And if that works, you're winning. If it doesn't work, go back to the comfort and start over. Now, knowing what is comfortable and what isn't is a trade secret.
Right. Do you hope that the people who will be working with you when you're using a band that you've just assembled for a job will have listened to enough of your records or heard you play enough so that they know enough about you to fit into your thoughts?
There are four or five songs that I compose that generally most musicians know because they're like standard jazz fare. They've played it somewhere along the way with somebody. So you don't have to, all I have to do is ask, do you know it? And then go ahead and play it. It's going to be a search period, at least the first time, but nonetheless, it still has the identity because it's my music. At the same time, there are other jazz standards by other people that I know I can do without going to, and there are standard songs that I know everybody knows. And if you go through a whole list of maybe 50 songs, 25 of them, everybody in the band will know. One person won't know one, and one won't know another, but 25 of them, they'll know.
On most of your records, there's a lot of your own compositions. On some of them, there's some jazz standards, and on a recent one, there's, for instance, a Harold Arlen standard, Come Rain or Come Shine, mm-hmm. which is it's been a standard for a long time. Mm-hmm. How do you like to divide on an album or on a date when you're playing the proportion of original compositions and jazz standards, pop standards?
Well, I don't make a division.
Mm-hmm.
To program a record is like programming a set. I mean, you know, when you get on the bandstand to play, you don't want to play music that does not have some continuity. Well, you can't very well play things in the same vein, otherwise the musicians get stagnant. And the audience doesn't want to hear things in the same vein all the time. That's one of the reasons I don't like fusion music, because it all has that constant drum thing. I don't know why people get caught up with that, because it seems boring after the first couple of minutes. It's the same thing over and over. Well, if you're going to play a ballad, you have to feel that at least it had some continuity with what you were doing before. So you can play a standard, then play a ballad and you'll have some contrast in what you do, and maybe a Latin rhythm song. So, you know, and there are various ways to program. A record should be programmed, I think, the same way. So it could be all original music. It could be all standards. It could be a mixture. It could be anything according to what you feel goals here today. You know, tomorrow you might feel differently. about the songs, but the programming you're going to feel the same way about all the time.
Yeah. Do you usually stop in record stores in the city that you're traveling through and see if they have your latest record there?
No. I don't pay attention to that because, you know, Martin Luther King had one of the speech, I think it's the one about the mountaintop. He says, I don't want to be a drum major. You know, they said, I want to be remembered for having led a committed life. Well, I'm no Martin Luther King, and that isn't what I mean either, but I want to believe that this music that I love and that I believe in so thoroughly, that when it's all over, that I want to be remembered for having been committed to something. I think everybody ought to be committed to something. I want to be committed to the music. If I let going in record stores, checking record sales and all that, then I'm not committed to the music, I'm committed to money. If I were going to be committed to money, then I should have played disco or fusion. There's no two ways about it. I think that one can live and live well and feel good about himself playing good music without making sacrifices for the benefit of record company executives or an alleged audience that is out there only for a particular kind of music. I think that you can play what you want to play and just be committed to playing that well, and that in the long run you'll be a happier person. And at the same time, you won't starve. I don't starve.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, I live very well according to my own standards.
You said before that the last record you've made is always your favorite, and mm-hmm. I'm sure in a lot of ways that might be true also with the band that you presently have. Mm-hmm. But has there been a period or a band that you've had that still stands out in your mind as being one of the highlights?
Oh, sure. At one point, we had a band that consisted of Walter Booker, bass, Roy McCurdy, drummer, Joe Zavenu, piano, and me and Cannon. There was about a 5-year period when I felt, and I still do, that we had the most cohesive unit in jazz during that period. We were always together, the same band. We had great communication, and there was a phenomenal growth period during that time in Joe Zavenu. He grew from a learning bebop piano player to a truly great innovator all in this 5-year period. So we tried so many things, and they all worked. We tried different times and different things, and it always worked as a cohesive unit sounding group. I think that particular period for the band was a remarkable period. For my own personal growth, I worked for, I think, a year and a half with J.J. Johnson, with just the two horns. For my own personal growth, I grew more in terms of where you start from and where you end mm-hmm. in that period, because I learned so much from J.J.
What was it about that experience?
J.J. is such a master musician that I'd have to be technical. I don't want to be that technical. Let's see how I can make it up. Well, I learned from J.J. an awful lot about altering chords, and it reflected itself all the rest of the time. Before that, I didn't know how to alter chords the way that J.J. did them, but J.J. is an excellent teacher also. He also, during that period, I learned how to voice instruments, how to put instruments in the correct octave, because, you know, a trombone and a trumpet is an unusual format. And the way he made it work was by skipping octaves. Without being too technical, that's basically as simplistic as I can put it. It goes a lot deeper than that, but then I'd have to get into technical musical terms, and it wouldn't work. But those two periods stand out for me as a great period of personal growth and a great period of group growth.
What's in the near future for you?
Well, a lot. There's always a lot in the future. First of all, I'm doing the usual thing. I'm playing. I didn't intend to have a band now, but the band came about by accident again. Last August, I had like a six-week tour and put together this band, the current band that I have. After 4 weeks of really excellent engagements, and business is great and the music's great, they convinced me to get to keep the band on a permanent basis. But in addition, we have the music from a Broadway show that Cannonball and I wrote this music before he died. We did an album called Big Man, had Joe Williams singing the story of John Henry and the steel driving man music. This play is about to get on the boards. And I had to rewrite much of the music because the script is changing and things are changing. I have to write new music. And I've been working on this now for the last 9 months or so.
That's really exciting.
In addition, that keeps me busy. Then I did a role as an actor in an off-Broadway thing.
What was that?
It was Mahalia's name. It was The Life of Mahalia Jackson. And it seems that, in fact, Mahalia Jackson and Louis Armstrong were very good friends. They were both from New Orleans. And so there's this character who's a spin-off character, like a Louis Armstrong, but not in fact. And I play that role. I'd never done any acting, stage. See, they had to have a trumpet player because on the theater, you can't jive around like you do in movies and television and have somebody faking the valves. On the stage, the sound would come from somewhere else and would destroy the illusion. Well, it's very difficult to find an actor who plays trumpet that well, who can sing also. You had to sing. So I did this role. Now it seems that play is about to go on Broadway. So I don't know exactly what I'm going to be doing 9 months from now, but I'm going to be doing an awful lot between now and then. And I just roll with the punches and do all these things because it's all very interesting, keeps me going, and I think it all affects the music.